From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Lynn Neary. And now, an impressive little boy named Awunder Leung. The 8-year-old from Wisconsin is, for his age group, the best chess player in the world. He recently took gold in the under-8 division at the World Youth Chess Championships in Brazil, and he joins us with his father, Will Leung. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Let me start by talking with you, Awunder. How long have you been playing chess, and what got you interested in it in the first place?
I've been playing chess for about 3.5 years, and I just liked it because it just seemed to work with my brain and just seemed like a good game for me.
Does your dad play chess? Is that how you first started seeing it?
Mm-hmm. My dad taught me how to play chess.
Oh, Mr. Leung, so you've been training him, so to speak.
Coach, so to speak. His brothers, the first move, they learned it in library, in Madison, Wisconsin. Yeah.
And do you play with your brothers?
Well, not really.
Why? Because they're not very good anymore compared to you?
Well, my older brother is the best besides me, and he doesn't really like to play, so.
I think maybe you surpass them. Is that right, Mr. Leung?
Yeah, that's the case, yeah. In the beginning, they play a little bit with each other. And then when I want to get better, you know, his elder brother, Jim, does not want to lose to Awunder. So,
so Awunder, do you like being able to beat your brothers?
Yeah, but he gets a little bit mad.
How did it feel when you won the championship?
I was pretty happy.
I understand you won in a tiebreaker. That must have been pretty hard.
Yeah, kind of.
Did that make you more nervous than usual, the fact that you had to win that tiebreaker in order to win the championship?
Yeah.
So when you get nervous like that, what do you do? How do you get yourself calmed down so that you can really concentrate on the game?
I just kind of took a nap and stuff.
You just took a nap. You rested. That's good. What did you do when you finally won? How did you celebrate?
Well, there wasn't much to do in Brazil, so I just took a nap too.
I think a lot of adults out there are going to be surprised to hear you say there wasn't much to do in Brazil. But was there anything that you really wanted to do that you weren't able to do?
Yeah, I wanted to go to the water park. It was a huge one, but unfortunately, it was raining there.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, Awunder, now, the next time I play chess, do you have any advice for me, any tips? What should I do?
Well, I'm not sure. Like, maybe practice on the general stuff, like castling and, like, get your pieces out, control the center.
All right, I'll work on that. That's Awunder Leung and his father, Will Leung. Awunder took gold in the under-8 division at the World Youth Chess Championships in Brazil. It was great talking with you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Shopping, smelling, not cooking, civility. That's a short list of themes in some holiday book picks from independent booksellers across the country. NPR's Susan Stamberg has the list.
The Toaster Project by Thomas Thwaites is Lucia Silva's favorite book this year. Some compliment, considering how much she reads. Lucia buys books for Portrait of a Bookstore in Studio City, California.
Everybody loves toast. Almost everybody has a toaster.
Thomas Thwaites decides to build one from scratch. He doesn't go to the hardware store. He wants to make every one of a toaster's 400 parts from the get-go.
He smelts his own iron ore in a microwave and mines copper from an abandoned copper mine.
More than 2,000 miles and $1,200 later, Thomas Thwaites has made a functioning toaster that would cost maybe $6 at the store. You do know that a simple long fork and some firewood could also brown a piece of bread. And speaking of bread, flour and water get fancy treatment in George Legendre's book, Pasta by Design. Rona Brinley at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach, Florida, says the pasta book has no recipes, no sauces.
This book is not for cooks, and I say that not being a cook. So it's really pasta as architecture.
92 different kinds of pasta, spaghetti, tortellini, rotini, gorgeously photographed in all their pasta white glory.
Do you remember when you were little and you made a necklace out of macaroni?
Sure.
Well, so this is pasta as art, continuing from your youth.
You cannot really smell the pasta, but Rona Brindley says there are plenty of smells in another of her gift book picks, Diana Abu-Jabbar's novel, Birds of Paradise, set in Miami, is absolutely redolent.
The smell of the flowers and the trees and the ocean.
Birds of Paradise is the story of a family whose 13-year-old daughter runs away from home, deciding never to go back.
And you don't know why. Nobody's done anything bad to her. Nobody has mistreated her. It's a loving family. She won't tell anybody why she's run away. So that secret really compels the story.
A real page-turner, Rona says. And Miami is as important a character as the young runaway and her parents. An adolescent boy is at the center of a coming-of-age novel picked by Daniel Golden, proprietor of Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee. Larry Watson's book is called American Boy.
It's sort of a series of snow globes. They're beautiful, scenic, pastoral, nostalgic settings, and then you shake up the snow globe and there's a blizzard.
Early 1960s in a small Minnesota town. Matthew's father has died. His mother waits tables at a supper club. He's befriended by a doctor's adolescent son. Into their lives comes a slightly older female. Matthew becomes obsessed by her.
She keeps him at arm's length. She will interact with him as long as she gets something out of it.
Her manipulative presence changes all the relationships. It's a story of longing, growing, drama, and, says Daniel Golden, beautifully written, spare, like the Great Plains. Ever put a book like that down, now I said a book, and torn off the edge of a newspaper, yes, newspaper, to mark your place? In California, Lucia Silva says there's a new book devoted to such placekeepers, Forgotten Bookmarks. At his family's used bookstore in Oneonta, New York, Michael Puppick has collected things he finds tucked into the books as markers, things like love letters, photographs.
So he finds a recipe for Mrs. Eisenhower's fudge in a copy of Nabokov's Bent Sinister. He finds two tickets to a 1904 masquerade ball in Elements of Greek.
And a collection of letters a daughter sends to her father in a nursing home. He tucked them into a copy of A Farewell to Arms. Memories drive Amor Towles' novel, Rules of Civility. Rona Brindley says the book grabbed her from page one. Manhattan, 1966. A husband and wife visit the Museum of Modern Art.
And they're at a retrospective show of photographs by Walker Evans. And he took pictures of people on the subway of New York at the end of the 30s into the early 40s.
In one of the photographs, the wife spots a man she once knew. He is clearly down on his luck, disheveled.
And on the way out, she sees another picture of him. But in this picture, he has a cashmere coat and a nice suit and tie, and the husband says, well, look, this is good. He's doing so much better, and it's a case of rags to riches. And then she points and says, no, you need to look at the dates. The second one is earlier than the first one. It's really a case of riches to rags.
The story cuts back to 1938, how the woman and a friend met that man on New Year's Eve.
We were going to perch in this lower-end bar where the music was taken seriously enough that two good-looking girls wouldn't be bothered and where the gin was cheap enough that we could each have one martini an hour. We intended to smoke a little more than polite society allowed, and once midnight had passed without ceremony, we were going to a Ukrainian diner on 2nd Avenue where the late-night special was coffee, eggs, and toast for 15 cents. But a little after 9:30, we drank 11 o'clock's gin, and at 10, we drank the eggs and toast. We had four nickels between us, and we hadn't had a bite to eat. It was time to start improvising, and that's when he came into the club.
From The Rules of Civility by Amor Towles.
If the pasta book makes you want to eat pasta, and the Miami book wants you to eat pastry, this one's going to make you grab a martini.
Finally, from book buyer Lucia Silva, A Christmas Tree for a Pin by Olivier Dunray. A book for children and everyone else, about a little girl and her big, burly father in a joyless home. The mother is absent, presumably she's died. Pin badly wants a Christmas tree. Her father keeps resisting. Pin charges ahead.
She heads out into the snow in her little red clogs and her excited pigtails, and she decides to cut down her own Christmas tree.
Eventually, the father helps, and the family begins to mend. The holiday feeling that's been missing starts to bloom.
It's about the real emotional core of the holiday, that Christmassy feeling.
No Santa, says Lucia, no lists, wise men, shopping, just the grip of Christmas on the heart.
I opened the pages and I fell in love with Pin, and I sat down on a chair and cried after I read it. And then I opened it so I could read it and cry again.
Good reads, and yes, maybe some good cries. Thanks to all our independent booksellers. Happy holiday reading. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
These and more book suggestions at npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
UN climate talks are, like many negotiations, a blend of dead seriousness and theater. Today, at the talks in Durban, South Africa, an American college student provided the theater. She shouted out a short, unauthorized speech during the main session of the talks. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, her interruption encapsulates frustration with the pace of the talks in general and with the United States' role in particular.
While real negotiations go on behind closed doors, the main hall of the International Conference Center in Durban has been given over to brief speeches, one from each of the 190-plus countries attending the conference. When it was time for the United States to take the podium, the room turned its attention instead to a young woman up in the galley.
You must set aside partisan politics and let science dictate decisions. You must pledge ambitious targets to lower emissions, not expectations. 2020 is too late to wait.
A youth group identified her as a college student from New Jersey named Abigail Bora. She was ejected from the meeting, but only after receiving a warm round of applause. And though her intervention was unorthodox, many other people have found ways to jab the United States more diplomatically. For example, Yu Linen from the European Parliament managed to dig at both China and the United States at a news conference yesterday, wondering why neither country has been bullish on a new legal agreement to replace the fading Kyoto Protocol.
The one is not yet ready and the other is not willing.
American diplomats are used to being the focus of criticism at these meetings, in no small measure because the U.S. has tremendous power to make a difference. But diplomats from both Republican and Democratic administrations move deliberately, not wanting to promise more than they can deliver from an always fractious Capitol Hill. Even so, the idea that the U.S. is delaying action until 2020 became such a meme that Chief Negotiator Todd Stern called a press conference shortly after the college student's stunt to rebut his critics.
I've heard this from everywhere from ministers to press reports to the very sincere and passionate young woman who was in the hall when I was giving my remarks. I just wanted to be on the record saying that that's just a mistake. It's not true.
Stern listed the many U.S. efforts to put flesh on the bones of agreements reached in the past 2 years. A lot of the criticism focuses on Stern's insistence about what comes next. He has repeatedly said that unlike the Kyoto Climate Treaty, the next agreement must put the U.S. and China on equal legal footing. And he has been saying the U.S. won't move forward without that first.
So what the U.S. has been doing over the last 2 years, with all due respect, has been showing the leadership necessary to try to drag this process into the 21st century.
The Kyoto Treaty excuses developing nations, including China, from reducing emissions. So many nations are unhappy to see their favorable status disappear. But Paul Bledsoe from the Bipartisan Policy Center says this is actually a rare time when the unpopular U.S. position makes sense both at home and abroad.
Killing Kyoto is going to play well on Capitol Hill. It's also probably the right thing to do in policy terms. We need to end this dysfunctional process and hit the reset button.
Just how big a jolt that ends up being depends on how these talks conclude Friday, or, as seems increasingly likely, on Saturday. Richard Harris, NPR News, at the climate talks in Durban, South Africa.
The food company Chiquita made the decision last month to move its corporate headquarters from Ohio to North Carolina. It said it was lured south in part by the number of flights in and out of Charlotte's airport. Cincinnati came out on the losing end. Like many cities, its airport hub is shrinking. Ann Thompson of member station WVXU reports on how airline cutbacks are affecting the city's business climate.
The Cincinnati Northern Kentucky International Airport, or CVG, is big and kind of empty. Business traveler John Bono from Atlanta was noticing recently how desolate it feels.
You know, I remember coming here a few years ago, and it was a hub of activity, you know, with all three concourses, and now there's only, what, one concourse left, if that? And it's just really amazing to see this huge infrastructure supporting very little flights.
In 2005, Delta offered lots of daily flights out of Cincinnati, 670 each day, with direct service to Amsterdam, Frankfurt, London, Rome, and Paris. But after a bankruptcy filing and a merger with Northwest, it now only has 170 daily flights and only one direct international destination, Paris. That concerns many here in the city's business community. Chamber of Commerce President Ellen Vanderhorst says they need to develop a business case for additional sustainable air service.
As everyone knows, air service levels at CVG are at a lower level than we would like to see and at a lower level than we think we can make a case for.
A new task force has hired a consultant, and big Cincinnati companies like Procter & Gamble, GE Aviation, and Macy's are lobbying for what airlines and routes they'd like to have. Aviation writer Jim Ott says Cincinnati certainly isn't alone with these kinds of challenges. Increasingly, medium-sized cities and their taxpayers are going to have to subsidize airlines to get better service.
Yes, with the mergers and the bankruptcies that occurred in the airline business, Pittsburgh lost out when U.S. Airways, you know, really de-hubbed at Pittsburgh. The same thing happened with American Airlines de-hubbing in St. Louis.
But Ott says Pittsburgh has turned the situation around, bringing in three low-cost carriers to supplement the legacy airlines and getting Delta to add a direct flight to Paris. Allegheny County Airport Authority CEO Brad Penrod says it wasn't easy.
For the first 2 years, we waived landing fees and certain gate fees, and we ran that out to the maximum allowed by law. And then the community, in the corporate Pittsburgh community, actually stepped up and say if a certain revenue dollar amount is not met, that the corporate Pittsburgh would make up to a $5 million payment for the first year.
Penrod says no more corporate payments were necessary, and the flight to Paris is now paying for itself. In St. Louis, airport officials and others have a plan to become a cargo hub. They were targeting China, but with millions in tax incentives failing to pass the legislature, the city may turn its attention to Latin and South America. Meanwhile, aviation analysts say the airlines will follow the money, and it will take a sufficient amount to add the flight cities crave. Ellen Vanderhorst at the Cincinnati Chamber says she doesn't expect Delta to go back to 670 flights a day at CVG, but she knows that for Cincinnati to attract and retain more business, it will mean landing more flights. For NPR News, I'm Ann Thompson in Cincinnati.
Now to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the home of listener Christine Bilkey. When we recently asked you to tell us about foods you enjoy during the holidays, Bilkey told us about a traditional Norwegian porridge called Rømmegrøt.
Rømmegrøt is a cream pudding that is cooked over a double boiler for pretty much the whole day. And then we put it in small dishes and cover it with melted butter and cinnamon and sugar, and then we eat it as an appetizer.
Sounds perfect for a cold, wintry day. As with many dishes brought over from the old country, the Bilkey family has tweaked the recipe.
I think traditional Rømmegrøt is made with just cream and flour, but we use rice instead of flour to thicken it. I have no idea when that started, and I have no idea why, but that's the way my family has always made it.
Christine Bilkey says it's the first thing her mother puts on the stove for holiday meals, and as it simmers, more cream is added to the mixture throughout the day.
It's a great dish for a time when you're in the kitchen cooking all day anyway, because you just put it on the back burner, and it cooks all day, and it doesn't take a whole lot of extra to be able to cook it and have it ready.
With all that cream, you hardly know whether to eat it or rub it on. If you would like to try Rømmegrøt, you can find the recipe for this and other holiday dishes at npr.org. You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.